Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, Red Beckman. Red, are you with us?
I'm with you.
And I believe our guest is on with us, too, Miss Janet from Colorado. Janet, is that a good way to refer to you this evening, or would you prefer something different?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Well, good. Janet, we always like to start off our show with a prayer tonight, and I if you don't mind, I'm going to say one right now.
Okay.
Gracious Heavenly Father, we just thank you so much for all the ways that you're blessing us in this country, especially the way that your Spirit is showing us the truth around us. And we just pray that you continue to reveal that truth to millions of people across this country. And I pray, Father, that the pain that is being felt across this country will be like lessons taught to people, and that they all can turn toward you and recognize that the way to find relief is by a relationship with you and your Son. Father God, I just pray for this country. I pray for our leadership, but I especially pray that those who will not turn to you and who are against the people of this nation, that you would squelch them, that you would shut them down, that you would defeat their efforts to commit evil in this country. And I pray that this night that Janet and Red and I can have a really good discussion, that we can bring forth truth that is in accordance with your will. May your Spirit go before us in everything we say this evening and all of our thoughts. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Well, welcome, Janet.
Well, thank you.
Red?
Yes, I'm here.
You got to meet Janet a little bit a couple of weeks ago when she called in when Walt Fitzpatrick was on the show.
Yes, and I don't, I'm sorry, but I don't recall all that was said at that time. I was kind of out of the picture, I think, right about then. And so what I heard, of course, got a picture of a lady that has got, I think she's got some fight in her. I think she has a real, she's got a bad taste in her mouth from what is happening to our country, in particular in her own family and life. And these are the people that are going to make a difference in this country. It just seems like we Americans, we have to be beat up pretty bad before we start getting the picture of how evil and corrupt our government is. And so, welcome, Janet.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to be rather quiet tonight.
Well, thank you.
Janet, give us a little history about yourself and let our listeners get to know you a little bit.
Okay. Well, I guess we're originally from Nebraska, and I guess our first really rude awakening was when two other families and ourselves bought a little rundown lumberyard. And my husband was the one that had the expertise, and so he ran the yard, and it was just it was just coming along beautifully, you know. And that's back when the Federal Reserve raised the interest rate overnight to 21%. And, of course, our markup on our hardware was only 17%. And so it didn't take long because we were pouring everything that we had back into it to fix it up. At the same time, we were getting all new products in. So, you know, if you start a business, it takes a lot of effort and money, you know. And so that was our first rude awakening, that kind of thing could happen. And of course, it didn't take long. In fact, a family-owned lumberyard in Lincoln that had been there for 80 years went down. And it took them a little longer, but they ended up going down too. And we look back on that time, and we see now that that was planned. There were a lot of farmers that lost their small farms. It was really the planned destruction of Middle America. That was our first rude awakening. The next thing I know is we have the IRS show up at our door. At our door. We had an acreage, and one day this man shows up at the door. He didn't even introduce himself. And I opened the door, and he just yelled at me, what half of the acreage you want us to take? And I looked at him, and I thought, well, what's wrong with this guy? And we didn't live far from the state hospital, and we had walk-offs before, so I thought that's what I was facing there, you know. And so I asked him, well, who are you? And he didn't answer me. And I thought, so I started to shut the door in his face. And that's when he just yelled at me again. And he said, what half of the acreage you want us to take? And it turned out this was the IRS. So it was just awful because obviously it happened so quickly. A few weeks after our lumberyard was stolen by the Federal Reserve, here comes their collection agency, the IRS. And, of course, back then, we were totally ignorant, like most Americans. We were totally ignorant about all of what's going on in this country or what had happened to misconstruct our government. And we were just living our lives, you know, raising our children, and we're excited that we'd gotten our first business, and Jim had worked for other people for over 20-some years, and, you know, it was time for us to start our own business, you know. Well, that, as I said, then we struggled to just keep our heads above water. And then finally Jim was hired by another big company and brought out here to Colorado. And so then he worked for them for a bit. But then they sold that company, and we were out of a job again. So this is the story of many Americans' lives right now. At that time, then he was in his late 50s, and of course jobs were short, and nobody wanted to hire people with expertise. They wanted to hire all new people, so they didn't have to pay him. Anyway, we got caught in a fiscal entrapment, and it just was one thing after another. And this is how we learned that the courts are so corrupt, because Jim said to me, oh, well, you know, I can just go to the judge and tell him what happened, and it will be so obvious that, you know. So I didn't even go to the court with him because we had two small children then, and I didn't even go. And when he went, he was just dumbfounded because when he went to put the other fellow, it was kind of a private hearing almost, and when he went to put the fellow who had entrapped us on the stand and started asking him questions, the very first two questions, the judge just yelled at Jim, you have no rights in my court, and shut him down. So basically, we were not allowed to bring our facts or anything into the situation, and basically, the what I call lying lawyer and the lying lawyer judge got a $20-some-thousand judgment against us, and we were really the ones that were entrapped. Then we really began to see, you know, it's just like, what is going on in this country? Jim, when he was standing in the courtroom, he said, I looked around after he told me I had no rights in his court, and I thought, well, what country am I in? You know? And then, of course, after that, I thought, now, this is enough. I'm going to start learning the law because I am not going to allow this ever happen again, you know? So I just set about joining some law clubs and learning and watching other people and learning from them and reading all I could get my hands on, and at the time we still had young boys in school, so luckily Jim made enough money that we could, you know, I could stay home with the children, which was always our goal, is always to stay home with our children. And And so I just kept learning. And I tell you, you know, I'm so glad you started the show with a prayer, because I know that all through the challenges that we met, we were guided. Even though we had very negative things happen to us, when I started studying and I started studying the law, and I really began to realize that I love the law, but they just don't uphold the law. You know, they don't practice the law. I have been a court watcher for I don't know how many people, and I've never seen a single judge uphold the people's rights to the law in 20-some years. Not one. And I've been to federal court. I've been to state court. I've been to county court. It's just amazing to me. But what we have is this is my personal opinion after watching all this, we have a private political club that is basically running this country.
Janet, I actually refer to the bar and the judiciary as one of the secret societies.
It is, absolutely. And every court that I studied, I began to see that these are courts of Star Chamber. Have you heard that term before?
Say it again.
Courts of Star Chamber. Look it up.
I have heard that term, yes.
Okay.
I have heard it.
And I began to see that because it was everywhere I looked. If I went to witness for someone else in court, to be there to witness what they were going through, I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe that this went in every court. And then I began to see it's because we have this private political club that has basically pirated our courts. And this is exactly what our forefathers escaped from the old countries. You know, so but as time went on and I was watching people in Denver, I would go to Denver to these law club meetings, and they would go in and they would study. They would dot their I's and cross their T's and study those statutes, and they'd go in and they still get slam dunked. And I thought, you know, if I ever get into one of those courts again, I am not going to play their game. And so it just so happened that, of course, in the meantime, I learned that, you know, the whole license thing, driver's license thing, is a fraud, because we're not in commerce when we drive our private cars. And so I learned that whole thing. And in fact, I wrote a whole document on government court fraud on that one issue. And I have, you know, Supreme Court cases and so on that prove that we have the right of free travel. But anyway, so our sons then, I thought, well, I'm just, you know, my boys aren't going to get licensed then. So they were traveling on their rights. And, of course, once we had terrible corrupt police, terrible, terrible. And I didn't know that. The first thing that happened to us when we moved into Soltown, by the way, we always lived in the country. I'd never had to deal with police anywhere. And then we moved into this little town, and we hadn't been here a couple of weeks, and we had a 14-year-old, and he'd gone up to the park to play basketball with another boy. On the way home, the police stopped them, made them stand straddle-legged with their hands on the cop car, and felt up their bodies. And when Seth came home and told me what had happened, I was livid. And I'd learned enough by then that I said, all right, I'm not playing their game. I called the sheriff's office, the county sheriff, and I said, I want to report a crime. Well, when the gal on the 9/11 call and asked me what happened, and I told her that the police had done what they'd done, and I saw that as child abuse, you see, I saw that as something that they have no right to do, okay? And this boy had sweatpants on with no pockets and a shirt on with no pockets. I mean, there's nothing this kid had that would have, you know, been, you know, something that he would be stopped and done that. Well, as things unfolded, we see that what happened is that they had such a corrupt situation here in these three little towns that it was like this you see in the movies about the South, you know. And so they would do this, and what they would do is they would entrap teenagers, and then they would have the children or the parents, they would charge them like with two or three things. Now, in this case, they didn't charge them with anything, But I think it was just their way of kind of brainwashing the kids into submission. You see what I'm saying? As I look back on that now. But when I called the sheriff's office, and she said, well, Sergeant so-and-so is on duty. She said, I'll send him over. And I said, please do. Well, when he came, of course, I just reamed him. And I said, you ever touch my child again or any of your people in your department, and you will be sued. Do you understand that? Don't you ever do that again. That child had done nothing. You have no right to touch him. You have no right to stop him. And, of course, I knew enough about the law. By the time this guy left, he was almost in tears because I really came down on him, you know. And I should have pressed charges then, but I thought, well, you know, I'm just one of these people that says, okay, that was a mistake they made or whatever. But then as time went on, they kept entrapping our teenagers. And I would go up to city council and I would lower the boom, and then it became a 2.5-year challenge, I guess I would call it, because I would forever, you know, stand up to them, and then they would entrap my sons again, you know, and they'd charge them with these things. Well, these three little towns are right in a row. The first time that I saw what they would do to a teenager in the courts, they had entrapped our other son in this town, two towns over, and he was going to work. I guess he worked at, I can't remember where he worked, Subway, I guess, at that time. And they stopped him, and this is what they would do. They would charge him, like, with two or three things so that then they could get the parents and the child to lie about one thing so they wouldn't be charged about two things. You see how this works? They get them to plea bargain, but the whole thing is a lie, okay? But parents were so busy working, so busy, you know, they didn't understand what was happening. They would get their child entrapped, and they were just happy to get rid of two of the charges, even though none of the charges were true. And so when they did that to my son, I had already written this document about government court fraud. And so when we went over to this little court over here, it was a female judge, and she called. Well, first of all, it was a long, long table, and she sat way at the other end of the table, and she, when she called Joel's name, you know, she asked his age. And so she knew how old he was. He was 17. And so I said, when I stood up, and, of course, by this time I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take the stance that I'm the common law counsel. And nobody I knew of had done this. And I just thought, I'm just going to do this, you know, because I'm not going to make motions. I'm not going to make pleadings. I'm not going to play their game. So I just stood up and said I wanted a continuance because I wanted them to learn the law, meaning the judge and the prosecutor. Well, that made her very, very angry. And so the town's prosecutor, called me into a side room, called us into a side room. And so the minute we sat down, I served him with this notice, okay? And their attack is to talk down to people. And so he started talking down to me, and I just stopped him, and I said, you know what? You better read that. And then he started reading it, and then you could tell that he knew that he had somebody that knew the law, and he didn't know what quite to do with this now, okay? And so I said, I want a continuance because I want you people to learn the law here, okay? And then I said, I'll talk to you about it, okay? Well, evidently the judge, it was such a little courtroom thing, you know, the walls were paper thin. It was just a little old Podunky town. And she must have heard what I said to her prosecutor. And so she was very angry then. When we came out, she was very angry. And so she called Joel clear down at the other end of that long table, away from me, where I couldn't hear what she was saying to him or what was going on. And I saw she said something to him, and then she put this paper in front of him, and she had him sign this paper. And I thought, now do you men recognize the crimes that have just been committed?
I do.
What were the crimes that she committed?
Well, for one, how old was your son?
17.
So she took him, a minor, out of the position not only of his guardian, but from his counsel.
Exactly.
And had him execute a document without giving him right of counsel.
Exactly. So the way I put it is, she extorted his signature without his knowing consent. Because he didn't know. He didn't know any better. Okay? And I could not believe it. And her chief of police stood there and watched her do it. And I thought, these people are just, you know, I couldn't believe it. And so, of course, what I ended up doing is coming home and I thought, now how am I going to handle this? And so I thought, in the meantime, I'd gone to a little workshop. And in fact, it was a friend that I'd met in Denver. She was a court recorder, and she could see all this corruption going on in the courts, and she didn't like it either. And so she'd had this fellow come, and he talked to us and taught us how to write a constructive notice. Have you ever done one of those?
Red, you've done that, haven't you?
I've not done constructive notices. I put a judge on notice. I mean, I do judicial notice.
What I learned was that in a constructive notice that you make your statement of facts. The second part is a law upon which you stand, and the third part are your demands. And because we are the sovereigns, and so I came home and I wrote a constitutional notice and demand. And I named the crimes that this judge committed and the fact that her chief of police stood there and watched her commit them and did nothing about it. So then I served her and every city council member with that constitutional notice and demand. And my demand was that, first of all, you know, that these crimes had been committed. And my demands were that they learn the law and they stop harming people. And I told them that they had, and then I did what I call a summary judgment on them. In other words, if you don't respond within 20 days, it stands as true fact and law in any court, anywhere, anytime, that these facts are true and correct. And, of course, I never heard from anybody. But, of course, they never wanted to see me again either. So then the next thing I know, they're entrapping the other son in this other little town. And what I started to see is that these lawyers and judges and these policemen were conspiring against the people in these three little towns. And so when they found somebody like me who knew or stood up to them, they just kept the pressure on. They would show up at 2:30 in the morning at our house with three cop cars. You know, they just, and of course our neighbors didn't know, you know, what was going on. And it just was a very negative experience. But I was not going to give up. And so every time that something, they would entrap one of my sons, I would serve him with another notice. And man, that was interesting that the same judge never, it was never the same judge. And so I began looking at that later, too, and I thought, you know, that's interesting that they don't put me before the same judge more than once. And I thought, you know, there's something going on here with, you know, obviously they know that if I serve them the second time, I can prove repeated behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then the last time they entrapped Seth on the way home. He was captain of the football team, and he had gone over to work out over at the school, and it was a cold, rainy night, but we have a garage. So he just pulled the car out of our garage and drove over, you know, and did his workout and then was headed home, and they entrapped him on the way home, and they took the car from him. And he asked them when they stopped him, he said, what have I done wrong? And they admitted to him. By this time, see, it was so obvious that this was just, you know, a Mexican standoff situation. They were always entrapping us. And they said nothing, but if you don't give us your keys, we'll break them. That was what these two armed men told this 17-year-old boy, right? So what's he going to do? He stepped out of the car, and they took the car. And he walked home in the rain, and it was a cold, cold night. And by the time he got home, I was so mad. I said, who did it? Well, by this time, he knows all the police. He knows their names. You know? And so he said it was this. He gave the policeman's name. And so I called the department right away, and I said, I want to talk to this policeman. And I said, you know, you just stole our car. So it's grand theft auto, and that's what the charge is going to be. And I hung up, and I called the sheriff's office again. By this time, the sheriff had gotten to know me pretty well, and he knew that when I was, you know, I always knew what the law was, and I always knew what our rights were. And so he had a lot of respect for us. There was another thing that happened to the county, too, which our Patriot group kind of took care of, and so... that's how I got to know our sheriff, and that's a whole other story. But anyway, so let's see, where was I? So they took this car, and so I told this police officer, I said, I want that car. That's my car, okay? And he said, oh, well, he said, it's over at this wrecker place, and which is on the edge of town. So I said, okay, but I'm coming. And he said, besides, that car's not yours. It's in your husband's name. And they just, you know, they would just play games with people. And I said, well, I'm coming to get my keys, okay? And so anyway, in the meantime, I'd call the sheriff's department, and they knew me well enough by then that they knew that I knew that what they were doing was not correct. And so they sent down a deputy. And when my husband got home from work, the deputy went with Jim to get the stolen car, okay? And they saw that when one of the charges that they charged Seth with the registration was outdated. And, in fact, it was not. And so when the deputy got there, he never said a word. He just accompanied Jim. But he walked around and he looked and he saw that what they had charged him with was a lie, okay? And so, of course, they had to give up the car. But in the meantime, because the police demanded to see Jim's driver's license, they then, and Jim said, you don't need to see it. You know who I am. You know, I've served on the city council. In the meantime, Jim had served on the city council. And he said, so you know who I am. You don't need my driver's license. You know this is my car. I am taking my car, okay? And so the police officer was, he wrote him up for not obeying the orders of a police officer or something. So now we had charges against Seth and Jim, okay? And instead of taking him into these little city municipal courts, I learned that they actually conspire against you across the county because they put us before the senior judge in the county court. And so we got summoned to there, and of course, again, I was acting as common law counsel, and it was interesting because the first time that we went up, the senior judge, I forget what he said, and we just said, well, we want a jury trial, okay? And he was trying to entrap us. I can't remember what all happened in that one, but he was trying to entrap us. Oh, I know what it was. We had gone round and round for an hour and a half, and, of course, I wouldn't make a motion or a pleading, so they really didn't have jurisdiction, and they knew it, okay? And so finally my son, who's this teenage boy, right, is standing there, and he's getting kind of tired of this. You know, we've kind of gone round and round, and nothing's, you know. And so finally the judge said something like, well, if somebody would just plead blah, 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 I could dismiss this. And so Seth took him for his word that he would dismiss it, right? So he looked at me and he said, oh, Mom, he said, just go ahead and make a pleading. And he turned to the judge, and he mimicked what the judge said. And the judge said, denied. And Seth just stood there shocked. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I've kept him out of this trap for an hour and a half. And he stepped right into it. But once again, what could I do about it?
I don't know, Red, what would you have done about it?
It's hard to say. Every state, for the most part, have different laws and different rules and regulations. And it's very difficult to draw a conclusion on something like this other than the fact that it doesn't make any difference what state you're in or county. The corruption doesn't go to Washington or come down from Washington, D.C. It starts at the grassroots and goes all the way to the top.
It really does.
But what I
ended up doing was I just withdrew it. There again, this judge is working with an underage person, right?
Yeah.
So as common law counsel, I just said, I withdraw that. This young man is not, he cannot make a motion, right? He can't
mm-hmm.
make a pleading, okay? And so then the judge didn't know what to do with this. And so I just stepped forward and I served him with a constitutional notice and demand. And what was interesting about this one is that I was trying to think, what in the world? Because I always put the pressure on the city council members, because I always, in my notices and demands, I always said, you know, you can be held personally liable because your employees, you have not trained them correctly, okay? And this is the truth. There's, you know, so I could always put pressure on the city councils. And, of course, they had learned after three or four episodes like this that this was my tack, that I would serve them with a notice and demand right in their pulpits, you know. And so the time before this, in one of the proceedings, there was another female judge in this other little town. And I forgot to tell you that one. Seth was in his bedroom studying, and it was close to our living room, dining room. And I had two of our law club members here, and we were discussing, and I said, you know what I just found out today? I've been reading. And, you know, they're going to arraign Seth tomorrow, right? But what I learned is, and looking it up, is they can't arraign anybody without a grand jury indictment. And so we were just discussing it kind of at the table. And, of course, by this time my sons had learned how to go in and claim who they were. So then that next morning, Seth was busy studying, and so that next morning when we went to go to this court, Seth said, well, Mom, what should I do? And I said, well, you know the tack. You know, you stand up and say who you are. And what I had them do is always stand up and say my name is and give their full name, including their middle name. And they would say, I always spell my name in accordance to proper grammar in upper and lowercase letters, but this is the clincher. And neither I nor my parents have ever given up my sovereign rights. And so they never knew what to do about that because, of course, they entrap you as a subject, right? And so that was kind of interesting. Well, anyway, so now we end up in this other one, clear up in the county, and I had no city council to put the pressure on. I thought, now what am I going to do about this one, you know? And I was sitting here in a prayerful kind of state, you know, at my computer, and I started to write something. And the word piracy jumped in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, why am I thinking of piracy? Right? So I got out my black law and looked up piracy. And do you know what the penalty for bringing piracy inland is? I began to think about this. This is a private club that has pirated We the People's Court. These courts belong to We the People, okay? And so I thought, well, that's what I'll do then. I'll serve him with a notice of piracy. Do you know what the penalty for piracy, bringing piracy inland, is?
Walking the plank?
No. It's life imprisonment. So I served as senior judge with the notice of piracy. He and every other Bar Association member doing business in that courthouse. And a month or so later, he retired, along with another judge up there who'd only been in office for a year. But, you know, they're like cockroaches. They come out of the woodwork. They're just... And so then this other... All of a sudden, we get this other summons. Because the senior judge, before he retired, we demanded a jury trial. And he knew that I knew enough about the law that I could really put the pressure on about that. So he had granted us this jury trial. But then he retired. So then we get this summons and this new judge. And so we went up and we looked at his oath of office. And I don't know what there is about that, but this particular, I haven't looked at more than his oath of office, but every word was in all capital letters. And I don't know what the significance of that is. But I thought, well, now this is interesting. But we ended up going, and again, he couldn't get us to make a motion or a pleading. And we kind of went round and round. And so then at a certain point, he took his recess. And I always tell people this is when they go and call the head communist to see what they can do or what they're going to do about it, right? And I'd already told him that statutes are not law unless they've been enacted into law. And, you know, things like this. And so as we went around and around, and the very first thing I asked the little district attorney was, the first question I asked her was, I would like to see the contract you have that the people in Colorado signed that says you can represent them. And you know what her
answer
was?
What was her answer?
Her answer was, well, I have to do what the DA tells me. And these are the kind of answers you get, you know, when you put them in a corner. And so, obviously, you know, they could see that I knew that this whole thing is such a sham. It's such an illusion, you know, that they've created. And so, anyway, I ended up, the judge ended up taking this recess. And the other thing about that was there were so many people in the courtroom that day. And I thought, well, what are all these people doing here, you know? There were two or three of our friends that had come to witness for us. But anyway, so during the recess, this man came up behind me and he says in a really gruff voice, well, what would you people do with the murder? And I go, well, sir, you haven't, I don't know who you are. You haven't introduced yourself. And it turns out he was an investigator from the DA's office. And I think what was happening here is that they had come over to see what these quote unquote common law people are going to do. You know, and they came over to see us actually get put in jail. That's what they came over. They were going to see this. They were really going to slam dunk us up there, you know. So the judge came back in after his recess, and he started throwing all these statutes at us. He threatened Jim with 6 months in prison, and he said he would fine me $1,000 for practicing law without a license. And we had already walked through that. We know they don't have licenses, okay? No lawyer has a license, really. And so that's a whole other story. But anyway, so I just sat there and I said, oh, boy, here we go. Because I know they can do it. They've done it. I've seen them do it to people. And so, but, you know, this is the risk you take when you go in. You know, you either stand up for the truth of facts and the law, and then you just have to, you know, pray about it. And so I sat there and I just kind of prayed about it for a little bit. And he was throwing all this stuff at us. And, of course, everybody, I think they were all getting a kick out of it. And then I just said to him, well, sir, I would like to ask one more question. And so he made the mistake of letting me ask the question. And I simply said, sir, would you please read Amendment 7 out loud? Because, oh, by the way, he had removed Jim's right of trial by jury, by the way, in all this threatening, you know, part. He'd removed his right to trial by jury. He threatened Jim with 6 months in jail, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so...
But it was, you had not set a common law court, however.
Huh?
You had not set a common law court at that point. They were still referring to him in all caps, correct?
I don't know what they were doing. We had established who Jim was when we walked in the courtroom. We always do. Okay? I always had Jim or the boys say my name is, give the full name, and say I always spell my name in upper lowercase letters in accordance with proper grammar, and I have never given up my sovereign rights, neither I nor my parents, okay? I always have them say that, okay? So that sets the court. From my point of view, I'm there to uphold the real law, and what they do, I can't control. It's like I tell people, they're criminals, you know. I don't know what a criminal will do, right?
Right.
And so anyway, I just said to him, well, sir, could you please read Amendment 7 out loud for the courtroom today? And he just sat there. And I said, sir, I would really like for you to read Amendment 7 to the court, people in the court today. And he just sat there. I said, sir, could you please read Amendment 7 out loud to everyone in the courtroom today? And he just sat there. So we just stood up, and I took Nick's hand behind us, and I said, well, Nick, I guess we're the only Americans in this courtroom today, and we walked out.
You just flat walked out on him.
Yeah. And so then we came home.
You let him off the hook.
Well, I understand, but I mean, you know, when you're in that position and you've got, you know, I bet we had half the DA's office there, you know. But anyway, I thought, you know, I'm glad to just get out of there and not have to, you know, pay $1,000, right? So I just walk out. And so we come home. Well, then I think it was a week or two later, we get another summons. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to waste our time forever, right? So I always show up because I know people who don't, they put a warrant out for your arrest, right? So we went up, and we didn't know what to expect, right? But I'm always, whenever I go up there, by the way, I always take like my public notice of government court fraud along or something, and I pass it out to everybody in the courthouse. So they hate to see me come because then people go away all learning the truth about what's going on about, you know, issues. And so anyway, so we get there, and this little assistant DA, this little female that I, you know, kind of cornered, she comes running up to Jim in the hallway, and she says, oh, Mr. Meisinger, can you pay a $14 fine? And so Jim says, well, we have a remedy for that, too. But, you know, and that was the end of it. We've never heard from him since. But it was a two-and-a-half-year ordeal because we just had to go round and round with him.
Now, you've assisted some other folks with some of these court cases as well, haven't you?
You know, I help people understand the facts and the law. I don't, of course, give advice. But I do help people
understand
their facts and the law. And I want people to be able to stand up for the law and their rights. That's my goal. And, yeah, recently I helped two other people. But, you know, it's, I think the answer is, at least for us, it was to learn the law, first of all, and second of all, to step outside their box and then turn the tails on them by serving them with notice and demand.
You've obviously done a sufficient amount of research to have come to some decisions about how our courts have gotten as corrupted as they are.
Yeah.
Well, what's your take on that?
Well, it started with the 1789 Judicial Act. Have you ever looked at that?
I have, but it's been a while. Our listeners probably have not, so just act like
you're stupid. You know what is wrong with that? They started early on misconstructing this country, and as far as I'm concerned, it started with the 1789 Judicial Act. It probably started with other things, too, but that's the one that stood out to me. And that put the Department of Justice directly under the executive. There's no separation of powers there.
Mm-hmm.
And they started early on, and of course you probably know about the missing 13th Amendment and all that other. But it's just been
a lot of people don't, Janet, and I would certainly welcome to hear whatever research you've done on that as well.
Well, I didn't do the research on that, other than once we learned David Dodge and who was the other fellow? Tom Dunn did the research on that. And when I got a hold of that research, I was going, oh, my gosh, you know, because that is, of course, along with what happened in 1913, you know, with Amendment 17, they, I don't think that Amendment 17 was really ever ratified. I mean, you know, to remove the right of our state legislators to select the senators that go to the national office.
Janet, I don't know if you know what Red's history is, but Red.
Oh, I do. I have Red. I bought Red's books years ago. The Law That Never Was. Right?
Well, they proved the 17th Amendment was not ratified at the same time they went back out and got the certified documents on the 16th.
Well, I just kind of intuitively knew. You know, it's like after you start seeing all this misconstruction going on, you're going, oh, so that's how they do it. You know, they just go 1913, you have the creation of the Federal Reserve, which is the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto. Then you have this. And at the same time, the creation of the IRS, which is the second plank of the Communist Manifesto. And then you've got, you know, they're misconstructing this, the way the senators are sent to the national offices, you know. And I thought, wow, look what they accomplished in 1 year, just in 1 year. But the piracy of the 13th Amendment, we went down to, I don't know if you've ever seen their little booklet that David Dodge and Tom Dunn wrote. Did you ever see their booklet?
I don't think so. No.
I have two cases of that printed because we just had some printed up because my intention is, when I get some time, is to send one to each of our state legislators. But it's excellent little booklet, and they
If you'll get a few of those in my hand, I've got a couple of those state legislatures that I'd be glad to put it in their hand.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Okay, well, we got to get together then. But it's an excellent little booklet, and actually the last state that they looked at on this was Colorado. And so they actually, in this little book, they actually have a photocopy of the revised statutes of Colorado of 1868, and it shows the real 13th Amendment in there. Now, you know, the Lying Lawyer Club is going to tell you, oh, you know, not enough states, you know, blah, 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 you know. Well, excuse me. This happened during the War of 1812, right? This is when they stole the 13th Amendment out, was in the War of 1812, right? And this is what Tom Dunn and David Dodge say, is that they are pretty sure that's what that whole war was really fought over, was the fact that the 13th Amendment was being ratified at that time, and it would have kept lawyers out of public office.
Well, I thought it was ratified.
It was. That's what I'm saying. But that's why they fought the war. And remember what they did?
Well, I know that they burned a lot of documents, and I'm not sure it's beneficial for us to to get too much into detail on that one, because I don't know that it's really in anybody's interest to bring that out too much. But you know, my point is, I didn't realize that it had disappeared that early on. I thought that it had been sandbagged, you know, closer to when they brought in the new 13.
I guess I'm not understanding. I thought that's what we were talking about, was the 13th Amendment.
Yeah, I think the document they have found the original 13th in a copy of the Constitution that was printed in 1868, if I remember right, or 1869.
Yeah, this is what I was just saying to you, that in their little booklet they actually have a photocopy of the revised statutes of Colorado. And we were the last state, evidently, that had it in our Constitution in 1868. Now,
right,
the lawyers would say that, oh, well, it never really got ratified. But excuse me, if it was 1812 when it, so you know, they burned the buildings in Washington, D.C., I think in an attempt to try to, you know, get rid of a lot of our documents, our founding documents, but... anyway, you know, this is 1868. How many years is that? That's 56 years later. It's still in this. I mean, it's still being printed in the Colorado Revised Statutes. Anyway, you'd have to see this research that, you know, that David Dodge and Tom Dunn did. And it's a really nice little booklet. It's really well done. And so, anyway. And I have plenty of copies, so if you want some, I can get you some.
I would like to get that sooner than later, because I've got another reason for wanting that, especially with what's going on next month with the election of GOP state officers and that sort of thing. I think it would be appropriate to bring this out here in Colorado before that March 26th election.
Right. And you saw that Mark has thrown his hat in the ring?
I was one of the people, Janet, that he was referring to that had been encouraging him.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Well, and see, I don't know. I was always going to get him a copy of this, but, you know, as we all are so busy, I hadn't done that yet. And so, but I will tell you this. Some members of our law club, we went down to the state archives because we a lot of times want to research things and make sure, you know. And so we have, and I have to find it amongst all my stuff, but we got certified copies from the state archives that indeed this was the authentic 1868 Colorado Constitution that has the real 13th Amendment in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some folks down outside of Colorado Springs that had brought that to my attention about a year and a half ago. And it's something I've wanted to bring out more in the Articles of Freedom for the Continental Congress as well.
Right. Well, just let me know when, you know, where I can get these to you or whatever, and how many copies you want.
Well, as you know, I'll be going to Brighton tomorrow afternoon for that memorial service for our great patriot that... as Red refers to it, murder by suicide.
Right.
That happened here last week. So I'll be up north, up toward the Brighton area. I don't know how far that is from, let's see, I guess I could swing back over your direction before I come back down this way.
Okay. Of course, in the afternoon I work, but Jim would be here.
Mm-hmm. I could use a half a dozen if that's not too many to ask for.
Oh yeah, I got two cases. So that I'm happy to do that for you. I'll lay them aside.
Well, Red, what questions do you have of Janet, or suggestions that you might have for Janet?
Well, I've tried to be quiet. You know, I have nothing but admiration for what Janet has done. And I'm not, I, well, 30, 35 years ago, we did a lot of that type of thing. Challenging, you know, the Mickey Mouse courts in your local community and such. And we found that we weren't getting very far as, and of course the Internal Revenue Service disrupted all of that pretty well. And, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And that was my my philosophy. Now, there was a thing or two that got my attention when she was talking about in that courtroom where she wasn't sure what was going on, and she basically was saying a prayer. Christ was getting ready to ascend into heaven to the Father, and he was giving last instructions to his disciples. And he told him, he said, you're going to be called before the magistrates. Excuse me. And you're going to have to answer questions or whatever. And he said, don't worry about what you're going to say. I'll give you the words. And I don't doubt for a minute that Janet has, you know, recognized that has happened to her.
Yes, absolutely.
It has happened in my life, and I've seen it, and I've recommended this to a lot of people to read that passage of Scripture and recognize what a tremendous gift was given to us there, where, you know, ask and you shall receive. That's what it amounts to.
It's very true. I mean, I every time I thought, gee, what am I going to do about this? The answers would come, and I would just do it. And often, even lately, you know, when the last two people that I was kind of assisting there stand up for their rights in the law, I would think, well, I wonder what they're, because I've never read their Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I don't believe in them, okay? So I just don't do that. And I thought, but I thought to myself, now I wonder if you can do discovery before, because I was going to have her do discovery before, you know, they go into court. I wonder if, or before a suit is filed, you know. And the very next day, I got the answer. That's happened over and over for me, and I'm so thankful. And this, I just am. I'm just so appreciative of having that assistance.
Many years ago, I made a statement. I said, there is a nightmare that haunts the legal profession. And the nightmare was that at some point in time, the population, the people out there in the street, may decide to study the law and learn the law. And so I'm here to tell you that it isn't a nightmare anymore. It's reality.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's a lot of things happening. And I guess I've got a little time here before. Or are we about close to the yeah, we're about to the break time here. And I'll have to tell you a story about which has happened just in the last couple of years. Are we going to have a break, Terry?
I think we probably need to give Kate just a minute to select the proper song for this moment. So about probably another 30 seconds here, and I'm betting she'll hit the button, and we'll be taking about a 3-minute break.
Yeah, I wanna bring out something that happened here very recently, and it's so important that we get a grasp on the law and how it works.
We'll be back in about 3 minutes, and with Red's story, with walls in our minds.
and not let Satan have one more. What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to the plate, took a stand upon God's promise, and stormed hell's rusty gates? What if his people prayed? And those who bear his name would only seek his face, yeah, and turn from their wrong ways. And what would happen if we prayed for those raised up to lead the way? Then maybe kids in school could play, and unborn children see light of day. What if the life that we pursue came from a hunger for the truth? What if the family turned to Jesus, stopped asking Oprah what to do? What if his people prayed? And those who bear his name would only seek his face, yeah, and turn from their own. He said that they would hear. His promise has been made. He answered loud and clear. Yeah. If only we would pray.
Who is it?
We are back. Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, I'm really glad you're with us tonight. And I'm really glad that we've got our friend Janet from Colorado here with us. This has really been educational, and I know that our listeners have been enjoying hearing this tonight. But, Red, we're ready to hear your story.
Well, I had a phone call from a fellow that he had been ticketed by some cops that were trying to raise revenue for the local municipal government, I guess. And they didn't write their summons right or anything else. But they tried to bluff their way through this, and they put him in jail. He had to come up with $750 cash for a bond to get out of jail. And when he called me, he was so flustered and frustrated because this battle had been going on for 6 months. And they were trying this railroad game of theirs, and one way or another, they were going to try to get that money. They had the $750, the bond, of course, but it was just so obviously that it was a heist It was these guys are like the road agents that were holding people up to be able to go down the road or cross a bridge. And so he told me the story.
Okay.
And I said, now, if what you're telling me is true, I wouldn't hesitate 5 minutes. I would go to the nearest federal courthouse, and I would file a Title 42 action, which is a 42 of the U.S. codes. That's the Bivens type of action. And I would file an action and demand that the finding of facts would be done by the law and the facts would be done by a common law jury, Seventh Amendment common law jury. And I said, when that happens, I told him, I said, don't put a figure in there. Just say that you will let the jury decide how much he had been damaged. And so when that happens, when people file an action such as that, the first thing that happens is that the city or the municipal that had, where it was their cops, they had to notice their insurance company, their liability insurance company, that they had been sued. And supposedly this is supposed to take the city out of the picture, and from that point on, the insurance company attorneys handle the case. Now, they come in very quietly. I know of a number of cases similar to this. Because it works in if it's a conflict created by FDA, ICC, or whatever alphabet soup outfit it is. It doesn't make any difference if you have been damaged by an agency of the government, why you can file these kind of actions. And I said, make your complaint very short and sweet, because you can get all the facts out. And I told him, I said, Rule 38, I don't know, Janet, do you know about Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure?
No, as I said, I of course, I've heard a lot about, you know, the Title 42 1983 suits.
Yeah, well, you want to look up the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 38, because a lot of patriots are saying that you can't get a common law court. We don't have any common law courts anymore. But Rule 38 provides for a Seventh Amendment jury trial. And, of course, you brought that out in your one of your traffic cases there. And of course, I don't know all the story, what happened, but... one of the first things you need to do when you get involved in something like that is try to get them to identify is the action a civil or is it criminal?
Uh-huh.
That's one of the first things you always want to do. And the Seventh Amendment only deals with civil cases. And the Sixth Amendment takes care of the jury for the criminal actions. Anyway, this gentleman, he filed that action, and it didn't take long, and he had a letter from the city attorney apologizing for what had happened, and he fell all over himself, saying that the cops did not write the ticket right and all of this kind of thing. And, of course, this fellow, I told him, I said, this is what's going to happen. But at some point, I said, the attorneys for the insurance company, they're going to come to you, and they're going to ask you what it's going to take to settle. And of course, you can have a figure for them. And I've known of some cases similar to this where the party that was damaged gets some pretty heavy are rewarded quite with quite a lot of money. And of course, it depends on how severe the case was and all that. But the insurance company doesn't really care how much they put out to settle this and settle it quietly, because they just raised the rate that the city has to pay for their liability insurance and gain it back that way. I don't know how much he has gotten out of them, but he was going after them with a real vengeance. And so I don't know what has happened because he hasn't contacted me again. But this is one way to handle this. I've known of cases where when a guy is stopped, gives the cop a hard time, perhaps. We always used to say you carry a tape recorder, and when you roll your window down just a short distance, you put the tape recorder up there and record the guys what he's saying. And, of course, today a video camera is even better, or these cameras that are in your telephone and all that kind of thing. If they get out of hand, which they will do quite often, then you've got that those damages that you can sue in federal court, and especially if it's a county, a city, or whatever, because they've all got liability insurance, and that's just a good way to go at it. But just kind of string them out. That fellow that called me, he really didn't know what he was doing, that he was doing the right thing by fighting him on this thing. He was fighting it on jurisdiction and everything else. I don't know how many times. He told me how many times he'd been in court, but I don't remember how many it was. But he would fight him to a standstill in the court, and then they'd set another date or so. And it hadn't been settled, of course, and he filed that action. And when the city, when the municipal judge, when he was served, it shook him up real serious. They knew what they were doing. They knew that they were trying to extort money.
Yeah, they always know. When you said that the city attorney then apologized, you know, they think they can get out from underneath what they actually train these police to do this stuff. And,
sure.
And, you know, and then, because like this man, you know, we went round and round for 2.5 years, you know, just constant, you know, this and that, you know, picking on us, harassment. And I began to realize, too, that, and at one point we actually held a common law court. Our law club in Denver, there was about 60 members that would meet weekly. And it was called the American Law Club, and they decided that we should do a common law court. And, of course, we're all just learning, you know. Nobody's ever taught us, you know, anything. And we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. And so the men, I was one of only, I think, 2 or 3 women, you know, that were members. And so they said, well, they want to do a common law court. And at that time, Jim was city councilman up here. And so I came home and said, we want to do a common law court. And he said, well, I'll see if we can use the city council chambers there. You know, so he went to city council, and they said, sure. So, and that was back, you know, when the Freemen were being harangued, you know, up there in Montana. And so we went ahead and did a common law court. Well, the men wanted to provide their own court martials, you know. And I said, I don't think so. I said, I know my sheriff really well. I said, how about if we just have him send down a couple peace officers, or at least one peace officer? And he ended up sending down 2. to help us with our common law court. And so we weren't attacked because we did it right. You know, the peace officers in our court were the county sheriff. And the neat thing about it was when we took our lunch, I was being the court recorder, and the two young officers were sitting behind me, and I didn't even get my lunch because they were so interested in what we were doing, and they had so many questions. So it was a really good learning experience for all of us.
That's outstanding. When was this?
That was back. It was whenever the Freeman. Remember when the Freeman were being
back in the mid '90s.
It was back in the mid '90s. Yeah.
I'm from Montana, and I'm the one that lit the fire under those fellows, and they got way ahead of me. They were a lot smarter than I was. And they were, you know, just really going after the Federal Reserve Bank and the banking situation. And I told them, I said, you better back off, and you better decide that you've got to train the jury first, because the courts are so corrupt. You've got to train the jury first before you do those kind of things. But they still had the opinion that you could win in the courts.
Oh, no.
If you were correct. And of course, it wasn't to be. You know, there were so many things that happened. They actually held court when at least one of them, and I think there was two or three, that were in the facility down in Missouri, Springfield, Missouri. They weren't even in Billings, Montana.
Right.
And they were holding court. And so the courts are so corrupt at this point. But I think, Janet, I think we have solved the problem. And over all the years that I've been involved in this, we've always known from the very beginning that the judges in the courts are our biggest problem.
Yes.
They are the ones that have really encroached on everything, and they're really a major problem because they think they have all of this power.
Yeah,
and so I think we have figured that out. We're using a technology, a legal technology, I call it, I think we'll be able to totally destroy the tax court because they're calling it a court, and it's not a court.
It's not, yeah.
And because there's no constitutional due process. And it's, you know, for some reason, which becomes very plain, clear after you've been through that. They've all got a conflict of interest because they are beneficiaries of the tax laws. And so when somebody gets a 90-day letter, why, we tell them to fill out their paperwork, get the paperwork from Washington, D.C., to petition the tax court. And when they get the return on that, and they will also say that they'll tell them that the petition has been filed and that the case would be heard on such and such a day and such a place. Well, we just tell people just wait a month or so. Usually the tax court is scheduled down the road 5-6 months. And we just tell them to file a motion to dismiss. Very brief, just as few words as you can, and you say that the plaintiff, or he's not a plaintiff, he's a defendant, basically, that he has been studying this. He got the 90-day letter, and he more or less panicked. What he does, he files a motion to dismiss, supported by, number one, a judicial notice, putting the judge on notice of his conflict of interest, and number two, an affidavit. And the affidavit is where you, and I tell him just one page should be enough, two at the maximum. And you say with it how that you panicked when you got the 90-day letter and you lost sleep and appetite, and you recognize that the IRS was a terrorist organization, a domestic terrorist organization, and that you had to get yourself informed. And so just basically found that he discovered that the 16th Amendment was never ratified and a couple other things, and that's it. And just sign it as a regular affidavit. And then you put in as an exhibit the Judicial Code of Ethics. And, if you got a yellow highlighter, well, you highlight the section that has to do with judicial conflicts of interest. We've never lost one yet that I know of. There's a lot of them out there, of course, I don't know about. But the tax court judge has no place to go. He is absolutely he's in a corner, and he can't get out of that corner. It's just an absolute impossibility. Everybody knows he's a government employee. He's a beneficiary of the tax laws, and therefore he has a conflict of interest. And if he has a conflict of interest, then he is denied impartiality. And he cannot make findings of fact or conclusions of law. In tax court, the judge makes all the findings of fact and conclusions of law. There's no jury. The judge, he says he's the one that does that in that case. Now, we're going to be able to domesticate the judiciary in this country because it doesn't make any difference what kind of a controversy you have. It can be criminal, it can be a civil case. You always want to, put the judge on judicial notice that he is a government agent. I have a letter that I did several years ago for a party in Montana, and now we've sent it all over the country to a lot of people. I make a comment, and you mentioned sovereignty. I ask people, well, you're stating that you're a sovereign citizen. Where in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, where do you find something that identifies and confirms your sovereignty? And that just seems like that stumps everybody. They just don't know where it's at. As far as I'm concerned, the only place in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that the sovereignty of the people is confirmed, and that is the Seventh Amendment, because it says in suits at common law, if the value in controversy exceeds $20, a right to trial by jury shall be preserved. And then it says this, it says, and no fact tried by a jury may be reexamined by any court in the land. And that word, that three-letter word, any, is so inclusive. I mean, it covers them all.
Yes, it does. Once I learned it, that's what I used all the time. When I when I notice them, I always notice them. I notice them under Amendment 7, Notice and Demand.
Yeah, well, here's what I said. I said the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in our land.
Yes.
Because because even the nine justices of the Supreme Court are nine government agents.
Yep.
I think we can, it's coming on strong with the economy in the pits and the anger of the American people building up, I think it's just a matter of time, and we will have brought the judiciary down with their black dresses and brought them down to the level where they recognize that they are a servant. They are not a master. And I could tell you some other stories that would point this out, how that these people can be brought down. And the way to do it, of course, is cite them for their conflict of interest. And they just cannot get around it. So,
yeah, well, that's true of any court then, because, you know, the county court, I mean, they're paid by taxes,
everybody. Yeah.
And I know recently one of the last persons I was helping here, she had not had a chance to be heard. You know, she'd been railroaded by two lawyers. The one lawyer took her for some $65,000 over a year's time, and what he would do is he would just call up the other lawyer, and they just kept running up the bill,
sure.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so finally, I don't know, she came to me and said, "What can I do?" And I said, "Well, have you ever had a jury trial?" "No." "Well, do you know about Amendment 7? "No." "Well, here's what it says. This is over money, right? A lot of money." And so I said, "You know, you need to have your jury trial, okay? I don't know what your lawyer did. He obviously doesn't know the law. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to go and we're going to ask for a county grand jury. But you know what? The DA's office blocked us." And the thing is, I threw the law at them right and left. And I noticed the DA's office and under Amendment 7. And my third point in law was the United States versus Williams. And you know about that case, right?
Uh-huh.
That's
yes.
A fairly recent case.
Uh-huh.
Where it said Justice Scalia said that writing for the majority, he confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, the executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. So there it is right there in a 1992 case.
Years ago, of course, I put my nose in the law books and I studied the case law and everything. I don't do that anymore, because now that I have gotten somewhat of a glance or a grip on the truth that the judges have a conflict of interest,
yeah.
I started looking at the case law, and you'll find that your law books, almost all of the opinions that are recorded there are where judges have made opinions and decisions. They've made findings of fact and conclusions of law. And you'll never find where the judge has cited the fact that he has a conflict of interest, which he should do if he's honest, and that all he's saying, it is his opinion. It is not law.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I'd like to see the day when we back a dump truck up to the courthouse and throw all that case law, all them books, you know, throw them in the back end of a dump truck and take them wherever.
Right.
But when you do that, or when we identify all of this law, they call it law, it's not law at all. And so if you write a brief and you cite a complaint, you don't want to use a bunch of case law. They'll answer with case law. And your answer to them is very short and sweet, because you just tell them that what they have cited, you know, is a bunch of court cases where judges have made findings of fact and conclusions of law, and they are just their opinions, and they're not being honest with us because they're not citing the fact that they all have a conflict of interest.
Right, and I learned that.
Because they are
government,
they're government employees.
And that's what I, that was one of the first things that I saw about this whole issue is every single court is conflict of interest. You've got private political club members officiating in the court. They're all officers of the court. There's your other conflict of interest, right?
Yeah.
So it's just one thing after, one layer after another of conflict of interest.
This is... This is rather profound, and what we're talking about here, and I hope there's people out there listening tonight that will pick up on this and do some research and some thinking. I'm getting up in years, and I'm just not able to think like I used to, and I am hoping that we get some young blood out there that will pick up on this, because I know that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of truth here involved in this. You know, how many times have we known of people that they get an order and is signed by a judge that they're supposed to appear in court on something? And it may be something, you know, that is fraudulent. It may be something, somebody trying to bluff you on something. A federal or a state judge have absolutely no authority to order anybody. Well, you probably remember back in the 80s, they did the school busing thing in this country.
Yes.
They got a decision out of a federal judge in Massachusetts saying that they had to bus kids back and forth between schools to get racial equality. And the judge granted gave the order that this was to be done. These lawyers all across the country, boy, they jumped on this, and they hit all the major cities very quickly. And they just worked their way down, and they found a match down in Louisiana, and a state judge down there got involved in this controversy. The federal judge had ordered two junior high girls to be bused 20 miles away from their normal school to, you know, help with this, you know, this mixing that they wanted. And all the media was down there. It was on the news every day for a couple of weeks. And then the federal judge, noticed the state judge, I guess, that he was going to cite him for contempt the next day if he didn't back off. And I won't tell you who, but there were some people that got to the state judge and told him to ask that federal judge, when were these two little girls convicted of a crime which gave him jurisdiction to sentence these two little girls to ride that bus? Because the order that he was giving was basically a sentence.
Yeah.
He was sentencing them, and that case was over so quickly. All the major media were there with their big trucks and their big dishes for communications and all that, and you never heard another word. I mean, it was dead. And school busing, you don't hear about school busing today, do you?
Hmm. Nope.
Not. It's not there. And we had all these highfalutin lawyers, expensive lawyers, working on that case for both sides. and the NAACP and ACLU and all were in there, and it was a real dog and pony show. But when the judge was confronted with that, just that little simple truth, he knew he had to back off, and he backed off in a hurry. So we've got to learn this, and I'm just hoping that there's some young minds out there that will take this and build on it, because well, I could tell you a lot of things, but I'm not gonna. It's difficult. I wrote in one of my little books, Walls in Our Minds. I wrote it in 1989. And I mentioned that there's a conflict of interest on the part of the judges. Here we are all these years later, and, 21 or 22 years later, and it took all time, through that time, I had a difficult time adjusting my thought process to handle this. And so what I've been trying to do now, of course, is that I don't want people out there to go through all the process that I did to think this out. I want them to be able to leapfrog ahead and start citing these judges for their conflict of interest in all cases. I don't care what agency it is that's trying to rip you off. You use this, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that I haven't grasped yet that some of these younger people should be able to grasp. So that's basically about all I have to say, I think, tonight. So go back to Terry.
Well, I think Janet's probably got some comments to make.
Well, one thing I would say about that, true, is what I learned from going through what we did is that, sometimes I would actually come home and I would do a martial arts bow after I'd be in one of their courts, because I always learned something, and it always forced me to learn some more. And I would do this martial arts bow kind of to them, because actually, to tell you the truth, if I had not had the challenges they put me through, I wouldn't really, really internalize that I am a sovereign. But because of what they pushed me through, I realized that I have internalized that now. And it's like, it's like I tell people, I don't know what they're going to do. People always say to me, well, you can serve them, but they don't respond to you. They don't blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't care what they do, actually. You know what? It's up to them, because I come from the higher law, and that is that it's just my job to state the facts, the truth, and the law, and to give them an opportunity to do what is correct. But if they don't do it, it's not my problem. They're the ones that have the problem. And a lot of people don't think about it from that point of view. But see,
it's
a spiritual thing. You know, if you go in and you, I don't go in angry. I just go in firmly, okay? And I just keep putting the law in front of them, and I keep giving them the opportunity to do what's correct. But if they don't, I just see that I've kind of been, how you were saying that and you get the answers when you need them. And if you pray and you stay centered and you keep asking for assistance, you get it. But I also began to see that I was kind of being used by spirit to go in and give them an opportunity to do what is correct. And if they don't, I mean, what can I do about it? It's their problem, right?
Right.
And so...
There's something more that we've got to consider if we're on this, as long as we're on this subject. One of our biggest problems in this country is the fact that we have the evangelical, the Pentecostals, and such churches out there who are teaching theological error. And that's where a lot of this, they don't teach sovereignty.
No, they do not.
They don't teach that.
No.
What they teach is that the government is sovereign, and they use Romans, the 13th chapter, And it is theological error that they are using, because they say let scripture, the first verse of Romans 13:1 says, let every soul be subject to the higher powers.
Yep.
And they say that means that we have to be subject to the government. Now, that is absolute theological error, because it says let every soul. That means Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and all the public servants, all of the Supreme Court, and all the rest of them are covered by that. They have to be subject to the higher powers. Now, what are the higher powers that judges and politicians, bureaucrats, what are the higher powers? Number one, they have to take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution for the United States of America. And then they are subject to God's law. You and I are only subject to God's law. We are sovereign, not over God. We're sovereign over the things that God has allowed us to have in our societies in the way of government. We are to be sovereign over government. And so we have a serious problem to get all of this across to to the American people, and especially these people in these churches that are being manipulated by their pastors, who are teaching theological error, and
yes.
It's a serious problem, and it needs to be dealt with. I'm not sure how best to do that. But here again, I'm hoping that we've got some young people coming along with sharp minds and such, and I can assure them that God will give them the words to speak when they need it. So we think about this sovereignty thing and how serious it is, but we really need to identify the biggest problem that we've got in this country. It's a, I figure it's a 50 to 60 million voter block in this country that are taught this in their churches. And that is a tremendous source of power for the government and for the courts. And it's just, we need to address it.
Yes. Well, you know, when you really get to studying, and hopefully other people will, when they've had to experience what we have experienced, will decide that they need to learn too. I know that last Saturday morning I took two laws to our Southwest Weld breakfast, our GOP breakfast. I just decided that, you know, people have got to learn some of this, you know. And so I just asked him. I had my Colorado Constitution. By the way, you were saying that there's nowhere that you can look to see that it says we're sovereign. But in our Colorado Constitution, it actually states that the people may alter or abolish their form of government. And that this is Section 2, Article 2, Section 2. The people of this state have the sole and exclusive right of governing themselves as a free sovereign. Isn't that interesting? But see, people don't know. And the state senator was speaking this last time, but Marge had me, I asked her if I could just have 2-3 minutes each meeting. And so she's going to have me do this every meeting now. And so I brought in two things. I brought in Article 61 of the Colorado Constitution, and I brought in Amjur 16, because I figured that's what people really need to know right now. That if something is passed as if it's law, and it's unconstitutional, it's null and void at inception. So I took that in, and the people really appreciated it, because you know right now people are so busy with their lives, and I know I was like that too. And if Jim hadn't been working to where I could study all the time, you know, I would be in the same shoes that those people are, where they're both parents are working and children, they have children in school and they have all these obligations, and how are they going to know, how are they going to learn this stuff when they keep being fed that this is a demonocracy and that this, you know what I'm saying, and it's not, it's a republic, and all these things that they've been brainwashed all their lives with because the educational system is so corrupt. And so I just thought, if I can just go in every Saturday, every third Saturday of the month, and take two or three really important things. But I took my Colorado statute book, and it is an older edition because I realized that you don't want to get the latest ones because so much has been misconstructed, you know. But it's so dog-eared, and it has so many little stickies sticking out of it and stuff because I have spent time studying. And I just held it up to the people, and I said, how many of you people know your Colorado Constitution? No one. I think there was one or two people that said they'd read a little bit or something like that. But this is, our Colorado Constitution is powerful, you know. And so if people would just sit down and read a little bit every week, and this is what I'm going to encourage them to do, what I said when I gave them those two laws, it was just a half a sheet of paper, and I passed one out to everybody, and I just asked them to please make 10 copies and give it to 10 more people. And,
the
you know,
first,
they, you know, they were
the first
really
thing you want to, the first thing you want to teach them is the intent of the Constitution. They have to have a real strong belief in the intent of the Constitution, whether it's state or federal. It doesn't make any difference. If they have a good grip on solid mental picture of the fact that the intent of the Constitutions are to keep government down where we, the people, can control them.
They restrict
and
the government, exactly.
Once they get a real solid hold on the intent, then the coming to the study of the Constitution is very easy, very simple.
Yeah, and I think they really were. I had one man that pulled me over as I was passing out the papers, and he said, you know, I always appreciate it when you come because you always ask good questions, and you you know, and this is just how everybody, like, we can influence other people. We can take just a couple things, and they're very, people are searching for the truth right now, but they just don't have the time. I look at it and I say, I pray for them all the time because these parents now are so pulled, you know, both parents working and children, and you know, I just pray all the time because that is how our opposition, by getting the mothers to have to work, they knew that that was the key, is to get the mothers to have to work. And then the families get pulled apart. And as you said, Jim and I quit going to church several years ago just because we just could see that it was just not upholding the law that's written on our hearts, is the way I put it, you know. There's a part of us that knows that when you are being violated, your rights are being violated, your spiritual rights, there's a part of you that knows that. But people are so into, they have just heard so much misinformation that they still know it. They feel it. They know it. But they just don't know what to do about it. And so if we can just give them a few tools, and I know when I saw that these people were going into court and they didn't know how to claim who they were and they didn't know this, and so some of us got together a few years back and from across the state, some of us had been studying, and I don't know how we all came together again. I think it was just God's hand, but I ended up writing a document, and it is Amendment 7, Notice and Demand, and what it does is, you know how the lawyers have turned everything on its head, and so now that the government is over the people instead of the people being over the government, and this document actually turns it right side up again, and it makes statements of fact, and it statements of law, and then it ends up, I wrote it as a legal document, a lawful document that we would publish. And so we did that. We worked on it, and we met for a year, and more people kept coming to the meetings. And so we ended up with 77 people signing this document. And then right at the last minute, this woman, who was one of the people that was a part of the group, I had arranged with I had been able to talk to a gal of the Denver Post, and we wanted it to be published in a paper that went statewide, okay? And so Denver Post was the only thing that I could think of that went statewide, and so I had made this deal with this representative of Denver Post, this saleswoman, and I told her what we were doing, and I said, you know, it's a full page thing, and so it's very expensive. Is there a way we can get a special rate? Because this really is for we the people, all of us in the state, you know, this legal notice. And she really liked the idea, so she gave me a special rate. And then this other lady that didn't even call me or talk to me about it or anything, we had gathered the money together over the year. You know, everybody, every time we met, once a month, people would put money into a pot, and we finally had enough money to publish it. And we wanted to get it published by July 3rd. It was, or July 4th, you know, so it was symbolic, too. And anyway, this lady called her and called her supervisor and got her into trouble because she thought that it was too much. And so and here this lady was giving me a special rate. Well, she ruined the whole thing. And here we were right ready to publish, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? So, again, I prayed, right? And then it came to me to call my my little local librarian in Longmont and ask her if there's any other paper that goes statewide. And guess what? There is. And it's the Colorado Statesman, which was even better because that's read by everybody in government across the state, and that's who we wanted to get this information to anyway. So it turned out just fine, you know. But again, we have to, you know, but that document, you know, we gave them so many days to respond again, you know, and if they don't respond, then this is fact, you know. And so that was a really good thing to do too. And everybody could do that in their state or their county.
Janet, are you aware of the new paper that is now starting to expand? The name of it's changing. It started out to be the Constitutionalist Today out of Colorado Springs, and now it's being picked up. The concept is being picked up by a new group. And it's called The Patriot Today.
I've seen that.
So that's going to be an interesting paper because it's not going to be controlled by people who are
manipulating the information.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I can share that. I'll dig out a copy of that too for you. So if you're going to come by, you can have a copy of that notice.
I'd like to have that.
Yeah. So there's just a lot of things we can do as people. And what I learned by going through all this is that, you know, we the people do have the power. We really do. We just have been bamboozled out of thinking we don't.
Well, Red's been saying for a long time that we have the power to do this. We just got to learn to use it.
Yeah.
And that's... truer words have never really been spoken. And, you know, I have to admit, it's not that easy to break out of the box and start to exercise that power.
Well, and especially I felt so fortunate in that I had the time to study, you know, because the more facts I got and the more law I learned, the more I felt stronger, you know. That information forms us from within.
Well, saying it over and over and over again, that when you start beating your head against the wall, you turn to prayer. And I have to tell you that, you know, I have trouble remembering who's sitting on my throne. It's especially my personality type. I'm what they call an ENFP. ENFP and or excuse me ENFJ ENTJ I'm sorry, which basically is a person who takes it in big picture and is a thinking decision maker. But we have a tendency to, you know, be waiting for the one of the Trinity to step aside so we can take its place. And it's really, I have to be kind of getting my forehead bloody before I stop and say to myself, wait a second, I'm not letting God go before me in this thing. And I keep hearing you say over and over again, you didn't know what to do, so you prayed.
That's right.
That's huge. That's a monster right there. That's a giant step. and getting people to recognize that maybe is the biggest hurdle.
Well, and you know, and in ways we've been taught to pray wrong too. And but you know, I think there's a part of us. It's like when I was even at 10 years old, I could see what they were telling us in the churches, and I saw conflict there in that, you know, when Jesus says, in the latter days you will do more than I, you know, I thought, well, then how can we be these sinners? You see, there was just this conflict that I saw even as a 10-year-old. And so I read the Bible twice when I was in those years, in my preteen years. And I saw a lot of conflict, you know, in what they emphasized and what I was understanding were two different things. And so then I learned, too, that when I pray from the heart. I mean, not from my mind, you know. I just pray from the heart, and then there's this part of me that trusts. Okay, I put it out there, and I'll get the answer. And it has always come. It has never failed. I want to tell you something. One time I walked away from my computer. I was writing something, and I walked away from my computer because I couldn't think of the word. You know how it is when you know the word you want, but you just can't get it out of your files. Your mind just doesn't bring it up, you know. And I was sitting there because I wanted to write this. It was only one word that I knew I really needed that I wanted to put in this whatever I was writing. And so I got up and I just prayed about it, and I just got up and left my computer. I thought, heck with it. You know, and I went in and fixed dinner or something. I went in the kitchen because I love to cook. And so I thought, well, this is, you know, I'll just go cook for a while. And then, you know, it'll come to me. You know how that happens sometimes. But do you know what? When I came back to my computer, the word was on my computer. Now, how do you explain that?
There's only one way.
Yeah,
I mean, you experienced it, and it certainly was an awakening moment for you.
Oh my goodness, I just couldn't believe it. I sat here and just stared at it, and
Janet, we've got about 2.5 minutes left, and I'm going to make an unusual request of you. We have about 2 minutes left. I'd like for you to close the show out by just giving us a prayer from your heart, just like you just mentioned. Would you do that, or is that as
That's fine. I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it.
You have the floor.
Okay. So what I'm doing is I'm just relaxing, and I just know that we are surrounded by all the help we need. And I am so thankful. I am giving thanks to our Creator for all of our blessings. We have so many blessings in this country. And we just want so much to return this country to the foundations that our forefathers established, which are based in the laws of nature's God. And there is nothing that can defeat us. And we are continuing to ask that all of our forefathers be with us, and that we come to a place of listening so that we can take the action, take the steps, and be blessed by all that has been given to us, and can help others see that we have these blessings, and to honor our Creator for all. Amen.
Thank you, Janet. This has been Walls in Our Minds. Thank you, Red. Janet, you've been a wonderful guest. I'm grateful that you joined us tonight. And I look forward to stopping by tomorrow.
Okay, and I'll have
you
things ready
week.
For you. God bless.
Thank you. Good night, Red.
Good night.
You might be a social guy with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the street. Money of drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a state trooper. It might be a young Turk. Maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Be living in a mansion, you might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord, you may even own banks, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. You may be somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk. Might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. Maybe sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Bobby, or you may call me Zimmy. You may call me RJ. You may call me Ray. You may call me anything. No matter what you say, you're still gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, and it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve.